Welcome back in, everyone, to a fabulous new Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper. We are returning to the Neurodivergent New Play series, and this time around, joining us to talk about their new work, we've got the playwright Dave Osmundson and the director Alan McLeod, who are here to talk to us about My Brother Jake, happening May 19th at 2 p.m. at Spit and Vigor. You can get your tickets and more information by visiting spitandvigor.com. We are always so excited to welcome another show that's part of the Neurodivergent New Play series. This one in particular is very exciting, and we can't wait to dive into it more and to share it with you. So with that, let's go ahead and welcome on our guest, Dave Allen. Welcome to Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you so much for having us. We're so excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah, I am so thrilled that you two are here. We've been having such a great conversation before we started. I could talk to you two, I feel like, for hours and hours. And just as Hal Prince once said, we just sat in the Walgreens eating bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches and talking about the theater. I'm just kind of like, where can we meet and how long can we go? But I really want to dive into this work that you have, Dave, that you've written, My Brother Jake. And I'd like to start first with you, Dave, and have you tell us a little bit about what the show is about.
Sure. So My Brother Jake is a two-person play about two twin brothers, Ethan and Jake, both of whom are autistic, but have different need levels. And Jake is the brother whose autism is, shall we say, less obvious, and he was able to have the inspirational, note my quotation marks, career and the wife and the children and all that, whereas Ethan's ambitions were kind of shunted to the side because people generally expected less of him. So in the play, they're at a point in their lives where Ethan has decided he wants to go to New York. He wants to pursue the theater. And Jake is like, I really don't know if this is such a good idea, which is complicated when you find out that Jake is kind of on the outs due to his own ableist behavior. And it's about two brothers trying to survive in an industry not designed for either of them and trying to figure out, I think, the best way that they can support each other without necessarily sacrificing their own artistic integrity.
That is a wonderful story. I love this. I want to build more on it. And I'd love to know, Dave, how did you come up with the idea for this piece?
Sure. So I read a book called Katherine Patterson called Jacob Have I Loved, which is about two sisters, one of whom is the beautiful, popular one, and the other is more of a plain Jane and ends up holding a lot of resentment towards her sister and thinking that her life is suppressed and that she'll never be able to leave because of her sister, when at the end of the book, her parents tell her, you've always had the ability to leave. And I was thinking about the inspiration for that particular novel, which is the Jacob and Esau story from the Bible, the quote being, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. In the biblical context, the term loved means like chosen to lead God's people, and hated means not, basically, from my limited biblical understanding. As someone who was raised Christian, I should know a lot more about the Bible than I do. But I was thinking about how, in this context, it can be about how we choose in the theater industry our artistic leaders, who are the ones who are going to lead us into the future, and like, what does that ultimately take? What kind of personalities do we want to see leading us and curating our new work? And then what happens when all that starts to crumble down? Because I was very interested in, I'm also very interested in the sea change in artistic directorship that is happening right now, where I feel like a lot of artistic directors are trying to program more diverse shows to varying degrees of success. you're seeing a lot of particularly Black artistic directors experience the glass cliff, where they are left organizations that are in financial shambles, and then when things go wrong, they ultimately take the hit for it. So I realize that the play is living in that historical context of this sea change of artistic directorship. And then I also just wanted to write about, I feel like a continual theme in my work is the way that as an autistic person, as much as I love the theater, I never felt that the industry specifically was for me, where either I'm too honest or I'm not good at networking or what have you. So those were some of the strings that I was pulling on in crafting this play.
That is wonderful. Wonderful. Now, Alan, I want to
Thank
bring
you.
you in on this. How is it you came upon this piece?
Well, I wish I had some sort of fantastical story to tell you, but Dave and I, it's through my collaboration with Dave. This will be, gosh, I don't know, the fifth thing Dave and I have worked on in like 2 years. Dave is a very, I don't want it to say he's a fast writer, because that I think undercuts the amount of preparation and dedication he has to his craft. But Dave writes a lot, and he writes a lot of good stuff. So whenever he tells me, oh, Alan, I've written this thing and I've applied for this thing, and if we get it, we're going to have a reading. I'm like, okay, well, can I do it? I assume I asked about this. I forget if you either he came to me or I inserted myself into it. But it's really just been through a very fruitful collaborative process with Dave. And obviously, I attempt as best I can to work on things that I connect with as a director and as a person. And I also just found the script and the concept very compelling. I think there's a, especially not that any of Dave's work or any of, my goal is never explicitly to like educate, quote unquote. But I do think as a byproduct of telling these types of stories, especially this one, a story that I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. I mean, the oftentimes there's a relationship where like, oh, the parents will favor one child over another for various reasons, but that's not what this is. This is two adults experiencing the same world in different ways due to their different level of need and having opinions on it. And I think it's something I'd certainly never seen dramatized before. And also just made for very interesting character study for some very good actors. So it spoke to me not just thematically, but as a compelling piece of theater, something that I want to watch. And frankly, also when I read a script, I there's always a metric I use, which is how painful is it to read the script? If it's a page turner, then there's something there that you can attach yourself to. And I don't think I've read anything Dave's written slowly. So that's my answer in a nutshell there.
That is a stupendous answer. I love it. I want to build on that because at the time of this recording, we are still just over a week away from the reading. But what has it been like developing this piece, Alan?
So it's been interesting because in terms of development, this is sort of a, this is the, Dave, tell me if I'm wrong. This is the first public presentation of this show.
This is the first time we are doing this play. This is the first time I'm even hearing this play out loud.
Yes. So in terms of, I have sort of a double-pronged answer to that, which is I don't know what it's been like developing the show entirely, because a lot of that is going to, that very fun process of great, rehearsal's over, bye actors, and then we sit in a room for an hour and discuss, and then Dave goes home and does stuff. So there's that aspect to it as well. I think in terms of development, so Dave knows what he wants as a writer, and I think that's also helpful, because I don't want to say that my job as director is entirely, a lot of people would say my job is to fulfill the vision of the writer. And like a large part of my job is that. But I also think that'd be a pretty boring job if, if you're in it to support, you can only serve someone else's dreams so many times. So you have to find something in it that you latch onto. So in terms of developing the piece, Dave and I are fairly aligned on what the vision for this is. So a lot of it has just been making sure we're on the same page, asking questions, Dave mulling over questions. I think it's really important that when you're in a room with a writer or writers, that there's never really a need for a quick fix. You let questions marinate, and as you listen to it or read it or hear it, the answers will become apparent. Oh, does this work? What do we think about this? Does this make sense? Does the energy drop here, et cetera? So part of it has been sort of guesswork about like, hey, here's what we think when this is read aloud will work and what won't work. And a large part of it is just collecting questions that through the process will be answered and adjustments made.
It's amazing. I love it. Dave, bouncing back to you, the writer of this fabulous story, is there a message or a thought you hope that audiences take away from this reading?
Ooh, I guess what I want audiences to walk away with is respect the dreams of autistic people, take them seriously, and support them in any way you can rather than dismissing them.
I really like that. I really like that idea. Alan, anything you'd like to add?
I mean, it's you put it so well, Dave. It's hard to say, because again, in terms of what I hope people learn, I hope people learn whatever they don't know already. And I say that, it sounds very circular, but I guess what I enjoy about this piece is that it's not designed to educate, but it can. And I think that sort of in jumping off of what Dave said in terms of like believe autistic people listen to their dreams, I think even just there's a tendency in the American theater and in theater in general, I include the UK, I will cast the shadow over them, that you have stories with autistic or neurodivergent characters, but it's not their story, or if it is their story, it's more about, I think about things like Corsicana. Sorry, Will Arbery, if you're listening to this. The character in that with Down syndrome was there to serve the protagonist, the able-bodied protagonist's plot. Or something like Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which I don't know what Christopher learned over the course of that show. It felt more about giving the audience a version of what it might be like to experience something through one person's experience of autism. And I think just the more we have plays, this play and other, about neurodivergent characters with deep internal lives and facing everyday issues. I think that we were doing a talk back or a Q&A at an event in Omaha where we were doing a show a couple months ago. And there were some legislators there as well, and also some people in charge of organizations. And there was sort of this long speech someone gave about work placement and how through these programs, we want to show that neurodivergent and autistic people can be productive. And somebody in the audience, and I broke the silence being the sole applauder of this person's comment, was like, how about seeing us as human before you talk about what we can do for other people? And I think just work, like any work that as a result of its aims as a story, humanizes neurodivergent people and presents them with deep internal lives. Like, that's what I want people to take away, is that this is a play with neurodivergent characters. You can call it an autistic play if you want, but ultimately it's a play about two brothers navigating what feels like an imbalanced relationship. And that's a very universal story.
If you need more specific, I guess, logline for it, I kind of call it my autistic true west, which is actually directly mentioned in the show.
That's amazing. Well, my final question for this first part, I'm going to throw at you, Alan, and I'd love to know, who do you hope have access to this piece?
Oh, gosh. I mean, ultimately, I would love for it to have as wide an audience as possible. I think that with something, especially with a series like the Neurodivergent New Play series, the outreach that they're doing is great, but I also imagine that there is a core of regular attendees who are relatively self-selecting. And, you know, people who already know they are interested in new work by neurodivergent writers or about neurodivergent topics. And I would say just like more. I think everybody, maybe that's a little greedy of me, but like everybody, anybody who's interested in learning about the lives of people whose lives are different from theirs, I would say. And I guess I'd say especially, and maybe this is referring back to another of Dave's plays, but I'd say especially, I would say perhaps like parents or siblings or family members of neurodivergent people, or people who are close to neurodivergent people who might not fully engage with them as people yet.
That's a lovely, lovely intention there. What about you, Dave? Anything you'd like to add?
I mean, aside from producers, you can give us money to do this at a larger scale. I hope that people come to see this who are willing to have their preconceived notions about autism challenged. I know like preconceived notions is like a buzzword at this point, but I feel like people bring so much bias into what they perceive to be an autism play, i.e., curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, that there really is no one form for that. It doesn't have to be necessarily hyper theatrical or through an autistic character's mind. You know, it can be mundane. It can just be someone living their day-to-day lives. And I think about Deanna Gent's play Falling, which is about a family with a very high needs autistic individual. And for me, the most successful parts of that play are the day-to-day. And yeah, I think just people who are willing to have the idea of an autism play or a play with autism or whatever person first, identity first label you want to put on that, challenged and shattered and built back up again.
Second part of our interview, we love giving our listeners a chance to get to know our guests a little bit better. Pick your brains, if you will. And I want to start with our regular first question, which is, what or who inspires you? What playwrights, composers, or shows have inspired you in the past or are just some of your favorites? And Alan, may I start with you on this, please?
Sure. I mean, I think the easy answer to give in the past is that seeing Next to Normal when I was in late high school changed the trajectory of my life and convinced me that this was worth doing. And I know that there are some problematic elements of that show, but what it really showed me is that, and this is not to say other shows don't do this, but it was the first thing I'd really seen that I was like, oh, this is about something. This is not a fluff musical. This is something that made me cry, which I wasn't used to doing. So that sort of set me on the trajectory. In terms of what type of work inspires me, ultimately, I'm of the opinion that any topic can be a compelling show if you execute it correctly. I think that what really interests me now in the realm of plays are, on a directing level, artists like Lilliana Blain Cruz or Lila Neugebauer or Rachel Chapkin. There are a lot of, it's not only women female directors, but there's a number of powerhouse female directors who are doing really incredible, subtle, metaphorically exciting work. Whitney White is another person who I will see literally any show Whitney White directs. In terms of writers, I think that it's sort of a hodgepodge. People like, in terms of plays, what I've been really excited by. We were talking earlier, like Jonah was something I saw recently that I found hugely inspiring. Plays that deal with the present moment, I think, are particularly interesting to me, especially plays that defy common wisdom to not talk about the present moment. I think that, you know, there are, for example, like a play like The Ally happening in November at the Public, or not November, in like January, February at the Public, or plays like Enemy of the People or the coming Eureka Day at the Roundabout, I think, is doing Eureka Day, or MTC maybe.
Manhattan Theater Club is doing Eureka
Manhattan
Day.
Theatre Club plays about public health and in a time when public health is something that no one really seems to want to talk about or important issues. And so the work that speaks to me are work that challenged an audience, I guess. Like, I'm not interested in work that sort of pats the audience on the back or appeals to them. The worst thing you can say leaving a theater is, oh, I agree with that. Like, I'm not interested in that at all. So I guess that's my answer in a nutshell.
I love that. That's a brilliant list. Dave, what about you? What or who inspires you?
Oh boy. Well, the play that inspired me to be a playwright, if I can go back to that, is a play I saw at Playwrights Horizons back in 2011. Called Kin by Bathsheba Duran. And it was one of those plays where I walked into it knowing nothing about it, and I wasn't sure what to make of it for the first 45 minutes, although I was really enjoying it. But then there came a moment where the structure of the play really clicked together, and I was like, oh, I see where this is going. I love plays that make me do that with their structure. I'm a big stickler for structure. I love a well-made play, but I also love plays that I call it structure with an F-bomb structure that I'm true. And I, you know, Alan also mentioned Jonah. I think that's the last play I've seen that does that really well because it asks for a little more mental work for your audience, but it really rewards their patience. I mean, I used to say that my work was like if Amy Herzig, Annie Baker, and David Lindsay Abaire had a threesome and then a bastard child, I would probably be that child. I don't know if I necessarily think that anymore. In terms of playwrights who inspire me, I mean, I just read I Was Most Alive with You by Craig Lucas, which left me shook in the best way possible. He also wrote the book for Light in the Piazza, which is one of my favorite musicals of all time. And also, like my fellow autistic or neurodiverse playwrights, like Harmon Dot Ott is a really good friend of mine. Their stuff is so bonkers and so out there, but so brave in its conviction that I just admire their work so much. So I don't know, in terms of like what inspires me, like Alan and I talk about this all the time. I don't write weird plays. I mean, what is weird anyway? What is normal? I just want to play that. I want to play that is willing to make me work a little and then says, this is what you worked here for. And that can manifest itself in many forms. It doesn't have to be a linear narrative or even a linear structure for that matter. Just something that I sit, I watch as an audience member. I realize that I need to work a little and I want to put the work in because I know the reward is going to be so great at the end. Something or something like, oh, this is a play I liked, I didn't love, but Stereophonic, where it was like 3+ hours, but I could just luxuriate in the slice of life fly on the wall structure of that play for 3+ hours. So I'm rambling at this point, but
No, these are
that there you
wonderful.
go.
I'm loving this. That's a great list, both of you. Fantastic list there. Building off of that, I want to know what is your favorite part about working in the theater? And Dave, I'm going to start first with you on this.
I think my favorite part of the theater is getting to know your collaborators and listening to their stories and where they came from and where they are coming to this particular project at this particular point in their lives. Alan and I just did the world premiere of my play, More of a Heart, a few months ago, which is about an autism warrior mom and her autistic son and what happens when he becomes an adult. And everyone involved in that, all the cast members, I should say, like, had a connection to autism somehow, whether they identified as autistic or whether they had a family member who was autistic or they worked with autistic people. And kind of just getting to know what all their journeys have been like and the ways that they intersected at this very specific point in time was just so beautiful to me. So I guess if I had to put it in a nutshell, it would be learning my collaborator stories and where they are coming from with this project.
That is a beautiful answer. I love it. Alan, what about you? What is your favorite part about working in the theater?
I'm gonna echo what Dave said about A, the people. You know, it's a stressful field in many ways. There's a lot of pressure. It's on a very small number of people to make something that feels very big happen. And the people are the are finding people who you really connect with and who you're all invested in bringing this thing to life. So finding people who share the vision and really want to play, the ability to play which is the director you don't always get to do. You get to watch other people play. Is I guess maybe you do. Is exhilarating. It makes all of the stressful parts feel like little blips. And the other thing I would say is my favorite part of working in the theater is seeing well-laid plans come together in a way that creates something thrilling on stage. And that can be everything from like an entire show to like a single second of a moment that you've had in your head for months. And you are very clear about what it's supposed to be for months, but it takes a little bit to execute. And on the day of tech or whenever it is, you finally see that thing happen for the first time. That's only been real to you, or maybe you and a handful of other people, and suddenly is real to everybody. I think that those two, the people and moments like that are the real things that I love about working in theater.
That is also a beautiful answer. Yes. And it leads to my favorite question to ask guests. And that, of course, is what is your favorite theater memory?
I'll give two. I think my favorite theater memory, just because of the impact that it had on my life, in addition to Next to Normal, was seeing Wicked when I must have been, it must have been like 2006. I must have been a young teenager, but I remember the impact that that had. I'll give this story. I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I made my parents take me twice more on tour within the next like 3 or 4 months of seeing that. I became obsessed. So just the feeling of, like that feeling I had is one of my favorite memories because it reminds me not just of where I came from, but also just what it means to create for a new audience and, you know, how that can inspire people. And then I'd say my other favorite theater memory is I was at the final dress rehearsal of the most recent Falsettos, the only Falsettos revival. And I don't know if you're familiar with that show, the whole set is like a big cube that's made of pieces and they reconstruct these pieces into the furniture for various scenes, which means that you have to set them up correctly or else they will fall down when someone sits or leans on them. So one of my favorite theater memories is being at that final dress rehearsal, and it's right at the top of Act Two. Stephanie J. Block is singing something like, it's that part of Fear of the Child, where it's, since it's the last loving thing we'll probably ever do together, let's act adult and not go crazy. And she's sitting down on a piece of furniture as she says that, and the whole piece of furniture collapses underneath her, and she falls on, that's not, the fall, Stephanie J. Block falling is not my favorite part about this. That's the least good part about all this. Granted, it was, you know, a couple from like sitting to the floor. My favorite part is that the entire cast broke at this, but powered through the rest of the song for the next like minute and a half, just stifling laughter. And it's moments like that that can only happen in live theater. And when you're watching a stellar cast, people at the top of their game, being adult theater kids and having the show go on, there's just something really magical about that. So I'd say those are my two favorite theater memories.
I love those. Those are amazing. I love those memories. Thank you so much for those. Dave, what about you? What is your favorite theater memory?
You know, the moment that, I wouldn't say it was a moment, I would say it was more an evening when, I know the show gets a lot of flack, but when I saw Phantom of the Opera for the first time and the overture was playing and the chandelier was going up like that, I just remember like being jump scared when the chandelier like lit up and then the overture starts playing and the chandelier creeps upwards. Like, and then I remember like watching actors on stage and thinking, I'm gonna be up there one day. Like, it's that almost stereotypical but nonetheless magical theater kid moment where what you want to do with your life is so clear. And like the fifth time I saw Phantom of the Opera, like that, the chandelier going up was still like chilling. Although even I will concede that it was time for that show to close about 5 years before, in my opinion, it should have closed, but oh well. But then nothing will take away the memory of seeing that show for the first time for me.
Except
nothing.
Replacing it with a new, less expensive memory, courtesy of Cameron McIntosh.
Yeah, but my memory is pretty solid. I don't think any downscaled production can interrupt that.
I love that memory, though. That is absolute gem of a memory. I love that you both told us your first with legendary Broadway shows. Of course, Alan, you with Wicked, and then Dave, you with The Phantom of the Opera. So those are just gems. Thank you both so much for those. As we wrap things up, I would love to know, do either of you have any other projects or productions coming down the pipeline we might be able to plug for you?
Well, as a matter of fact, there is. So for the next project you'll be able to watch from Alan and I, you will get to see me act where so the Rogue Theater Festival is going to be presenting a digital reading of my play, Let Me Know If I Hurt You, which also looks at a queer autistic person navigating the theater industry, but in a very different context. And that is going to be presented by the Rogue Theater Festival from, let me get the dates up. That's going to be from June 3rd through 9th. And you'll be able to buy tickets through the Rogue website. I think May 21st they go on sale. Don't quote me on that. But that is the next, that's the next project that we have coming up. And I'm also working on the novel.
That's
And Dave, I feel like
amazing.
you should plug your new play that's also getting a reading in Joisy shortly.
This is why I keep Alan around. So I don't know when this is going to drop, but on May 15th, I have a reading of a new play at the Incu at the with the at with Art House Productions for their incubator program. The play is called We'd Rather Know If You Weren't Coming Back. And it also deals with autism, but this time there are ghosts. And it's a haunted seaside town. It involves a ghost tour. And that's all I want to say about it. Because my other hyperfixation, in addition to theater, is also ghosts and ghost tours. Like, I love ghost tours. So this is my ghost tour play.
You are among friends. We will get together and party. Alan, anything for you that we can plug?
So, other than the shows Dave mentioned, on my end, the summer is a lot of, if you ask me in like 2 weeks, I could probably give you two things I could plug, but I cannot plug them yet as I do not know when they are happening. So, keep an eye out for stuff from Alan McLeod. But aside from working on Dave shows, I have a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. The secret to art is have money. And I think we're just waiting on a couple of people to have money to see what these things are going to be. Don't listen to that kid. That's not the secret to making art. That's the secret to producing art.
Yes. I
The
love
art of making art is putting it together bit by bit, block by block. Like that song, like laid it all out there for us.
And now all we need is the counterpoint, which is the art of having your art produced is deconstructing it carefully so that anything you've been asked to remove doesn't affect anything else, bit by bit, piece by piece.
Love
Well,
it.
let's hope it doesn't come to that, but hope in
Yeah.
this world.
Well, that leads to my final question, which is if our listeners would like more information about my brother Jake or about either of you, maybe they'd like to reach out to you. How can they do so?
So I don't maintain a website, but I do have a new play exchange page where you just search Dave Osmondson. I am on there. You can reach out to me through there. Most of my plays are on there. My brother Jake is not on there quite yet. I think I'll probably put it up in the next month or so. And yeah, I'm also on Facebook and Twitter at Dave M. Osmondson and Instagram at Osmondson D. And yeah, that's how folks can reach me and keep up with whatever the hell my life is.
My website's currently under construction. Eventually, you'll find it at me at alanmcleod.com. But in the meantime, you can find me on the Devil platform known as X, formerly known as Twitter, and at amcleod717 or lurking on the Broadway World message board.
Wonderful. Well, Dave, Alan, thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me today, for sharing this amazing show and just your amazing insight, especially those memories. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Andrew. This was so
Yeah.
great.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. This has been lovely. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you. My guests today have been the playwright Dave Osmondson and the director Alan McLeod, who joined us to talk about their piece, which is part of the NeuroDivergent New Play series, My Brother Jake. It's happening May 19th at 2 p.m. at Spit and Vigor, and you can get your tickets and more information by visiting spitandvigor.com. We also have some contact information for our guests, which will be posted in our episode description as well as on our social media posts. But make sure you come out for this amazing reading. Get on the ground floor of this fabulous piece. The show again is My Brother Jake on May 19th at 2 p.m. So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez, reminding you to turn off your cell phones, unwrap your candies,
and keep talking about the theater
in a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
And be sure to check out our website for all things Stage Whisper and theater. You'll be able to find merchandise, tours, tickets, and more. Simply visit stagewhisperpod.com. Our theme song is Maniac by Jazzar. Other music on this episode provided by Jazzar and Billy Murray. You can also become a patron of our show by logging on to patreon.com/stagewhisperpod. There you will find all the information about our backstage pass as well as our tip jar. Thank you so much for your generosity. We could not do this show without you.